Today we're going to be looking at Joshua chapter 9. And this is the account of the treaty that was formed with the Gibeonites. Joshua 9 verse 1. And it came to pass when all the kings who were on this side of the Jordan, in the hills and in the lowland, and in all the coasts of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard about it, that they gathered together to fight with Joshua and Israel with one accord. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they worked craftily, and went and pretended to be ambassadors. They took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins torn and mended, old and patched sandals on their feet, and old garments on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a far country. Now therefore make a covenant with us." Then the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you dwell among us, so how shall we make a covenant with you?" But they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" So they said to him, "From a very far country your servants have come, because of the name of the Lord your God. For we have heard of his fame and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon king of Heshbon and Og king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. Therefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions with you for the journey, and go to meet them, and say to them, We are your servants. Now therefore make a covenant with us. This bread of ours we took hot for our provision from our houses on the day we departed to come to you. But now look, it is dry and moldy. And these wineskins which we filled were new, and see, they are torn. And these our garments and our sandals have become old because of the very long journey.'" Now notice what we have in this account. It's so easy to think in the wrong way about things. In fact, we tend to think that the main issues in life are physical and the spiritual are secondary. That is our natural inclination. The reality is that the main issues in life are actually spiritual. And the physical are the things that are seen, and that is merely the framework of what is really important. One of the measures of whether you are having spiritual success in your life is whether determined opposition rises against you. You see that happening here. They were having spiritual success as they were doing God's work, conquering the land, and huge opposition arose. Now, Israel is taking possession of the land. And that's a fulfillment of what God had said back in Genesis 15, verse 16, that would happen when the iniquity of the Amorites was full. So now it's beginning to happen. That's being fulfilled, and the inhabitants are desperate. Now notice this account that we read. There are contrasting responses to a desperate danger. Both parties have the same information. There are two different approaches. The foolish approach is to resist those who had a powerful God. That's what these kings did, the ones that banded together. The wise approach would be to desire for peace with those who had a powerful God. In other words, when you start thinking about it, you have a group of people here, and it is evident that they have a powerful God. So if you're dealing with these people, and you're hoping they won't conquer you, and you're hoping you can win and battle over them, you've got to contend with the fact that they have a very powerful God. So it's not just like it might at first seem. It's not just like, well, they have this many warriors, we have this many, we are better marksmen than they are. It's not that kind of thing. It's far beyond the physical thing. But notice, the foolish response is, one group said, "We are going to resist these to the utmost and try to triumph over them, even though they have a very powerful God." And the other group said something different. It is impossible, in essence, to fight against this God. So we better take a different course. And we are going to see if we can make some kind of peace treaty to get us out of this jam and save our lives. So you have the belligerent resistance in verses 1 and 2. Now, as we go into chapters 9 through 11, you'll find that Israel is opposed by coalitions of cities, not just individual cities. In other words, it's not just Jericho and then Ai and then the next city. It's a coalition. People are realizing we've got to band together to solve this. So in chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, you have six kings. In chapter 10, verses 1 to 5, there were five kings who came against Israel and the Gibeonites. In chapter 11, verses 1 to 5, you have many northern kings. And in each case, these coalitions formed because they heard of the exploits of the Israelites. They heard, this happened and this happened. And we've got to get together to stop this thing. Now notice, these kings are no longer paralyzed by fear. You remember back in chapter 2, verses 9 to 11, Rahab was talking about what was happening. And she said that when we heard the things that your God did for you, our hearts melted. And that same idea was rehearsed in chapter 5, verse 1. You see, those people that heard those things, they knew that the crossing of the Red Sea was not due to Israeli ingenuity and scientific principles. It wasn't that they had figured out something amazing, that they could make the sea go like that and then they could just walk through. They knew it was their God that did this. It was their unique God, namely Yahweh, the God of Israel, wasn't one of these other gods they've been worshiping, that had dried it up. And when they saw what Israel did to the two mighty kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, you know, when we heard this, we, plural, Rahab would be saying, our hearts melted. Why did they melt? Because the Lord, namely using the name of Israel's God, Yahweh, because the Lord your God is God of heaven above and earth beneath. And so Rahab asked for the strongest oath possible. She didn't ask for an oath by her gods. She asked those men to swear an oath by that God, by their God, the Yahweh God. And so they heard that the Lord, referring to that God again, Yahweh, had dried up the Jordan for Israel to cross over. You can see that in chapter 5, verse 1, and their heart melted. So that's the early situation, but now these people's heart is not melted. Instead, they joined together to attack Israel. I think it's very likely that this shift occurred because of that first defeat at Ai. In other words, with that first defeat, they realized that Israel was not invincible. We beat them once. And so, if they could band together and quickly destroy Israel, they would have success. Now, that shows the long-term effects of national sin. It's very possible that if Israel had been faithful, victories could have been obtained with lesser conflict and less trouble, you might say, more like Jericho. See, so often people do things that are wrong, and that sets in motion a sequence of consequences that changes the picture. So these opponents, their heart is not melted now. In fact, they are saying, we will band together and we're going to solve this problem. So that's one approach. No longer paralyzed by fear. If we band together, we can lick them. The problem is, they are not taking into account God Himself. It's almost like if we band together, we can finish them off. We have hope. No matter what you think, if you are in opposition to God, you have no hope. The other approach is the one taken by the Gibeonites. And they decided to obtain safety through deception. Obviously, they're in a crisis. Because you see, these other kings are banding together to make a coalition. Now, what shall we do? Shall we stay in the coalition? That'd be one possibility. Or shall we leave the coalition? Which shall we do? If we stay in the coalition and we have victory, guess what? That would be wonderful from their standpoint. We can keep living like we've always lived. By the way, that's what many people want to do. Just keep living like they always lived. So you can see how staying in the coalition would have a great appeal. Let's stay in there. Let's give them all we've got. And hopefully we can have victory and then we can keep on having life like we've always had it. But what if we have the coalition and we are defeated? Then what? They knew that that meant they would be utterly destroyed. In other words, that's the pattern they can see. Israel comes in, conquers a city, and utterly destroys everybody. So the other option is to leave the coalition. Well, now, if they leave the coalition, if they hope for just staying in their own city and being safe, it's almost certain they'll be annihilated, right? So that isn't a very good choice. Well, what if they leave the coalition and just surrender to Israel? Say, we don't even want to fight. Well, that isn't a very good choice because Israel's command was to kill all the inhabitants. So the only choice that really makes any sense for them, from their standpoint, is if we could obtain a treaty. That's their only hope. But the result of such a scheme is unknown. I mean, what if Israel finds out that they've deceived them? They might be annihilated because they deceived them. Well, what if they don't annihilate them? What is very likely? They would be doomed to a dreadful life, maybe of slavery. So you can see that their options are not very good. What did they choose? They chose to try to obtain a treaty and then hope for mercy. In other words, they were willing to lose everything in their old life in the hope of saving their lives. Do whatever it took to obtain a peace treaty. It reminds you of what Jesus said one time, doesn't it? He who saves his life will lose it. So you see the five kings, they're trying to save their way of life and they're going to lose it. And these, in a certain sense, are losing their life. They know that whatever happens, it isn't going to be the same. They'll save it. Now, of course, it's not in the same kind of way because they're resorting to deception. Remember, these people are pagans. They aren't following God, but they do know one thing. That God is powerful, and there is no hope in opposing him. You know, that's just such an important lesson. It's amazing how many Christians will go down certain paths because they think that they can win by opposing God at certain points. You can't win that way. So, verses 4 to 6, they pretended to be ambassadors. And they came at first with just implicit evidence. They dressed up in a certain way. They had certain provisions. They did all these things so that it would look like they had been on the road for a long time. You know, they had old sacks. And they had old wineskins, and they were torn and patched, and they had old patched sandals, and they had old garments, and they had dried up bread. And then in verse 6, they said, we came from a far country. We'd like to have a treaty with you. Well, you can see that in verses 7 to 8, Israel is suspicious. In fact, in the story that we have, the account, the narrator calls them Hivites. Verse 7. And so by doing so, the narrator explicitly identifies them as somebody named in the Mosaic law that was supposed to be destroyed. You can read about it in Exodus chapter 34, verse 11, Deuteronomy 20, verse 17, and Joshua 3, verse 10. In other words, the ruling by Moses at the mouth of God was that the Hivites were to be destroyed. No covenants with them. But if these people were from a far country, a covenant was not forbidden. You can read about that in Deuteronomy 10, verses 14 to 18. So, Israel is suspicious. And Joshua says, "Who are you and where do you come from?" So they begin to explain their position, verses 9 through 13. They said, "Well, we came because of the fame of Yahweh." The fame of, and they use the specific name of the Israelite God. Now they knew the source of their danger. They knew the source of their danger was not the Israelites. They knew, verse 9 and 10, the source of their danger was Israel's God, Yahweh. "When we left home, we had new equipment and new provisions. And now it's all old and it's wore out because we had to come so far." Now notice this. Israel did not notice the clues that these men were not from a far country. One thing to remember is they were suspicious. And you know, it's worth contemplating if you feel suspicious about something. Verse 7. Don't just say, "Oh, well, I shouldn't think about that." Because sometimes being suspicious is because you can't put your finger on the problem, but something isn't right here. Then give it some time. Do some investigation. Think. Ask God about it. Notice how these men answered the questions. "We are your servants." Wait a minute. That's not what he asked. And then, very vague, "We're from a very far country." "What country?" "Tell me about your country. What's it like there? Do they have rivers? Is it desert? You tell me, what's it like?" And then flattery. Quickly change the subject to the marvelous exploits of your God. Now, you can't flatter God too much. You understand that. But you see, instead of answering the questions, they're evading the questions. In fact, did you notice that they wisely omitted the crossing of the Jordan, the defeat of Jericho? Why? Because if they were from a very far country, they shouldn't have heard of that yet. So you see, they were clever. But besides, verse 11, if they were so far away, why would they want to be servants of another nation? That doesn't make sense. I mean, imagine sending a delegation hundreds of miles and saying, "We'd like to be your servants to another country," when they're hundreds of miles away. Why would you do it? And besides, the things they brought along were too old. I mean, even a far journey in the ancient Near East shouldn't have taken more than a couple of months. Why would you keep on carrying worthless bread with you? Notice that the Israelites did not test the assertions of these ambassadors. They could have said, "Well, show me something that you brought along from your far country to see how is it different from the things that are local." You remember, God had seen Achan's stuff under the tent. Nobody else, apart from his family, knew about it. And God could have revealed these liars. One of our problems is that often we do not notice details that would make correct conclusions obvious. Have you ever found that the case when you were buying something? You look at this article and you think, "Oh, it's good, 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 nifty. That's what I want." And you buy it. And you get it home and it's like, "Look at that. This thing has this ugly, nasty feature. Or it's lacking this ability or something. Why didn't I notice that? I would have left it in the store. It happens sometimes, doesn't it? Well, you see, these kind of things can happen in these kind of circumstances as well. And so often we don't notice the details that if we had paid attention to those details, we would have said, no way, I'm not going down that path. You know what that should do? The very fact that we identify with those kind of comments shows that we should be asking God more. It shows that we should not trust ourselves so much and we should call on God for insight, because it's so easy to miss the things that are important. And so Israel failed on this occasion, verses 14 through 17. Then the men of Israel took some of their provisions, but they did not ask counsel of the Lord. So Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the rulers of the congregation swore to them. And it happened at the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, that they heard that they were their neighbors who dwelt near them. Then the children of Israel journeyed and came to their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon, Shepherah, Beeroth, and Kirjath-Jearim. What you notice regarding this failure of Israel, you notice the danger of being successful. Now think about Joshua chapter 1. Joshua was given personal and comprehensive promises from God in chapter 1. Chapter 1, verse 5, God would be with him and bring success. That's verses 5 through 9. He said in verse 5, no man can stand against you all the days of your life. I will not leave you or forsake you. Verse 7, don't turn to the right or to the left, that you may prosper and have success. Verse 8, meditate day and night on this law and do it, and then you will prosper. In verse 9, I will be with you wherever you go. Now, for all we can tell, Joshua was living faithfully. So you could expect that, yes, here's what God said, I'm living faithfully, and so I can have these kind of promises operate in my life. And these promises are truly wonderful, and they are backed by the powerful and faithful and reliable God. Not only that, what a success they had at the miracle Jordan crossing, where the water stood up. It's like a dam was there, invisible dam, just stood up as a heap, just kept damming up more and more and more and more and more and more, and then they could just walk right across till they all went across, and then whoosh, went down. And then the miracle victory at Jericho, go around the city, go around the city, go around the city. On the seventh day, go around seven times, and shout, and the walls fall down. And you advance right into the city that's totally defenseless. Then they had the disaster at Ai. And the lesson that should have been learned right there was the arrogance of not asking the Lord before attacking Ai. They could have dealt with the Achan problem earlier instead of later. If they'd have said, Lord, shall we go up? And he'd have said, no. Why not? Because there's sin in the camp. Deal with it. You see how they can bypass that first disastrous attack on Ai. Now that episode should have been a strong warning against complacency. Oh, we went across there at the Jordan when it was a flood stage. Oh, the walls of Jericho fell down. Oh, Ai is not a very big city. Don't bother to make the people work so hard. Just send a few up there. And boom, they had a disaster. See, when you're successful at the blessing of God, it is very easy to become complacent, self-satisfied, and think that you did it, even though theoretically you know God did it. Well, after they dealt with sin, God promised them victory over Ai. And God gave his direction, and God gave his blessing, and God gave detailed instructions for the battle, and they followed those to detail. And they had detailed obedience in relation to the covenant renewal. You see, they're being very careful to obey. Is that good? Of course it's good. But it doesn't guarantee success. As long as they were obeying, it did guarantee a certain kind of success. But remember, success is dangerous because it's so easy to not concentrate on God as the source of success, and that without Him we can do nothing. So they come to a new situation. These ambassadors come and they want to make peace. Now, they checked to make sure that they were following God's direction about not making a covenant with anybody in the land. That was good and that was right because they knew they were not supposed to do that. So, where do you come from? Maybe you dwell among us. Oh, we're from a far country. So you see, they were checking in relation to following God's commandment. And it doesn't seem to be a problem. So let's go for it. Watch out. Notice that very ominous statement in the last half of verse 14. It says, "But they did not ask counsel of the Lord." Now, literally, here's what it says in Hebrew. They did not ask the mouth of the Lord. Turn to Numbers chapter 27, verses 18 to 21. "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Take Joshua the son of Nun with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. He shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, he and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation.'" Notice, there is a specific command in relation to Joshua. And there's a procedure that Joshua is supposed to do as he is dealing with leading the people of Israel. You find that procedure outlined in verse 21. Joshua was supposed to stand before Eleazar the priest, and the priest would ask for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. Now, there's debate about exactly what the Urim and Thummim were. It seems that there were two stones, and no one knows exactly, but it seems that those stones could give a yes or no answer. Nobody knows exactly how. Maybe the yes stone glow brightly, then that would be yes. And if the no stone glowed brightly, that would be no. We don't know those details, but there was these two stones, and they could get a yes or no answer from the Lord. So when Joshua is going to make a decision about going to battle, you see it says there, go out and come in, or maybe even a decision about just moving from one campsite to the other, he is supposed to stand before the priest, Eleazar, and the priest is going to ask God for an answer by using the Urim before the Lord. And the word for ask, sha'al, is the same word that it's found in Joshua chapter 9, verse 14, where it says, "They did not ask the mouth of the Lord." And it says here in Numbers 27, verse 21, "At his mouth they shall go out, and at his mouth they shall go in." And it's using the same wording because it talks about the mouth of the Lord, and it's talking about his mouth. In other words, you have the wording which we find strange, and so we don't really tend to say it that way. We'd say at the command of the Lord. But this wording occurs various times in the Old Testament, the mouth of the Lord. And sometimes it's translated the command of the Lord. And I think maybe occasionally it'll be translated as the mouth of the Lord. This is one of the reasons why I like a very literal translation, because it jostles your mind to make connections that you don't necessarily make otherwise. Now, obviously, you can become too literal in some of the translations, so it's a translator's choice and it's not easy to make. But what we're saying here is that in Joshua 9, verse 14, it says they did not ask the mouth of the Lord. And in Numbers 27, verse 21, Joshua is given a specific procedure to follow. He's supposed to go to the priest. The priest is going to use the Urim to get the judgment. And at the Lord's mouth, Joshua is supposed to lead the children of Israel in and out. You see, God's word has the answer for our situations. How? Joshua 1. If we meditate on God's words day and night, and if we obey the details. If they'd been meditating on those words like they should, they would have remembered, oh, here's an occasion to stand before Eleazar the priest and have him ask the Lord, and then at the Lord's mouth, we'll know exactly what to do. Isn't that a pity? But see, we often do that kind of thing, don't we? We aren't spending enough time meditating on the Word of God and getting the details of what God has said so that we know what the answer is that we should be applying in a given situation. And so, Israel made peace with them. Joshua made peace with them. He made a covenant to let them live. And the rulers of the congregation swore to them. Notice what they're doing. They are blindly making a covenant and they're swearing by God to disobey God. Because they're actually going to let the Hivites live. And they're swearing by God that they will let them live, which was in disobedience to what God had said. And then they participate in what I call a belated investigation. They heard that the Gibeonites lived nearby. Oops. So then they traveled a little ways and they found out it's true. They checked it out. Verse 17. Well, pity that they didn't check it out before. Have you ever had the experience of buying something you thought was really great? And when you got it, it wasn't so great. So then you checked some reviews on the subject and found out it was bad. You could have found out before, but you didn't bother checking before. It's a typical human response. Study more after a disaster that could have been prevented. So how do they resolve this dilemma? Verse 18 through 27. But the children of Israel did not attack them because the rulers of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord God of Israel, and all the congregation complained against the rulers. Then all the rulers said to all the congregation, "We have sworn to them by the Lord God of Israel. Now therefore, we may not touch them. This we will do to them. We will let them live, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath which we swore to them." And the rulers said to them, "Let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers for all the congregation, as the rulers had promised them." Then Joshua called for them, and he spoke to them, saying, "Why have you deceived us, saying, 'We are very far from you when you dwell near us'? Now therefore, you are cursed, and none of you shall be freed from being slaves, woodcutters and water carriers for the house of my God." So they answered Joshua and said, "Because your servants were clearly told that the Lord your God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you, therefore we were very much afraid for our lives because of you and have done this thing. And now here we are in your hands. Do with us as it seems good and right to do to us." So he did to them and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel so that they did not kill them. And that day Joshua made them woodcutters and water carriers for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord in the place which he would choose even to this day. You see how this whole event brought confusion to the assembly. God had commanded those people to be killed, and they had made a binding agreement in the name of God not to kill them. And so now the congregation is angry at the leadership, verse 18. It's very evident that the congregation wanted to kill those people, and Joshua prevented it, verse 26, because destruction of the Gibeonites would have brought God's wrath upon the congregation, verses 19 and 20. So they arranged for them to be woodcutters and water carriers, verse 21. Notice that slavery was what it cost the Gibeonites. In fact, according to Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 10 and 11, slavery was the price for making peace with Israel. If you decided you were from a far place and you wanted to make peace with Israel, you had to become a slave. And Deuteronomy 29, verse 11, specifically mentions these tasks, woodcutter and water carrier. So verses 24 to 27, Joshua confronted them for their deception, and he makes them slaves in the house of God, verse 23 and 27. He says, you are cursed. And then, of course, in verse 24, the Gibeonites explain why they thought deceit was necessary. Because they knew about Moses' commandment. Isn't that interesting? They knew about Moses' commandment. You might like to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. Similarly, Deuteronomy 20, verses 10 to 18. When you go near a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace to it. And it shall be that if they accept your offer of peace and open to you, then all the people who are found in it shall be placed under tribute to you and serve you. Now if the city will not make peace with you, but war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God delivers it into your hands, you shall strike every male in it with the edge of the sword. But the women, the little ones, the livestock, and all that is in the city, all its spoil, you shall plunder for yourself, and you shall eat the enemy's plunder which the Lord your God gives you. Thus you shall do to all the cities which are very far from you, which are not of the cities of these nations. But of the cities of these peoples, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive. But you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite, just as the Lord your God has commanded you, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations which they have done for their gods, and you sin against the Lord your God. When you besiege a city for a long time, while making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. If you can eat of them, do not cut them down to use in the siege, for the tree of the field is man's food. Only the trees which you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down to build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it is subdued. So you notice they could make peace with certain people, but they couldn't make peace with these, and the Gibeonites were Hivites. And these Gibeonites knew about Moses' command to utterly destroy them. And so, in their mind, the only solution was to deceptively obtain a treaty. Also, Gibeon would have been a careful observer of how Israel operated as a destroyer. They had seen what had happened to those other cities. And they were given two areas of service. Service to the congregation, verse 27, and to the altar of the Lord. Now, what were the results for the Gibeonites? Like Rahab, the Gibeonites were convinced of the reality of the true God. You can see that in verses 9 to 10 and in verse 24 and 25. They left the Confederacy knowing the danger, but their faith was mixed with pagan deception. Now, if you glance at chapter 11, verses 19 and 20, you'll find that God had mercy on the Gibeonites. He did not harden them like he did the other kings. He hardened the hearts of the other kings so that they would fight against Israel and be destroyed. But he didn't do that for the Gibeonites. Why? God has mercy when people turn their hearts toward him. And so, the Gibeonites recognized the true God, and they recognized that we don't want to fight against him, but then their solution was connected with deception, and deception is not honoring to God. What about Rahab? Very similar. She knew that was the true God. She wanted to be on that side. She was changing sides, in essence, between being a Canaanite and now being an Israelite. These people were changing sides. And so God has mercy on people whose heart is turned toward him, even if they have not perfectly understood all of his ways yet. Aren't we glad? And these people proved to be faithful down through the centuries. The Gibeonites responded to God's mercy by allegiance to him. In fact, they had work to do in the religious setting, and that led to religious privileges. The city of Gibeon was given to Aaron's line. David put the tabernacle there. Solomon burnt offerings there when he ascended to the throne. And the Gibeonites, according to Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 7, came back from the captivity and helped Israel rebuild the walls. Now here's a question. Was Israel obligated to uphold a covenant that was based on deception? Couldn't Israel have said, look, we made a covenant on the basis of what you told us, namely that you were from far away, and we're not supposed to make a covenant with anybody near, and you lied about it, so our covenant is invalid. So, off go your heads. Could they have said that? A lot of people, when confronted with similar principles, would have said, done, right? The covenant is invalid, so we're not going to follow it. Does the Bible give the answer on this? It certainly says in this passage that, oh, if we break this covenant, the wrath of the Lord would be upon us. Now, maybe they were mistaken. What do you think? Can you prove it from the Bible?
Somewhere it is. I don't know where.
Okay. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 21, verse 1. Here's an account of something that happened in the days of David. Now, there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. So what's going on there? David knows something is going on because it's not normal to have a famine 3 years in a row. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, "It is because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites." Now, isn't that an interesting thing? Saul and his bloodthirsty house, so it involves not just Saul, but his family. And in his zeal for Israel and for the Lord, he did this. Notice verse 2. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. The children of Israel had sworn protection to them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. Notice how he has misplaced zeal. Saul was told to kill the Amalekites and utterly destroy them, and he didn't do it the way God said. But now, what's he doing? He is killing the Gibeonites because of his zeal for Israel and Judah. It's a false zeal. He kills Gibeonites in the violation of the Gibeonite treaty. And notice that the judgment came on the nation after Saul was dead. The famine was in the days when David was king. And David is inquiring of the Lord, saying, what is going on here? And so David says to the Gibeonites, verse 3, what shall I do for you? How shall I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? In other words, what can I do so that you are asking God to bless our nation? The Gibeonites said to him, we will have no silver or gold from Saul or from his house, nor shall you kill any man in Israel for us. So he said, whatever you say, I will do for you. Then they answered the king, as for the man who consumed us and plotted against us, that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the territories of Israel, let 7 men of his descendants be delivered to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord chose. And the king said, I will give them. And then the account goes on to tell about how those men were killed, and how that eventually, as they performed what the king had commanded, after that, verse 14, God heeded the prayer for the land. Now, people wonder about this. But you see in verse 1, it makes it very clear that Saul's descendants were involved in this slaughter. It wasn't just Saul. And that explains, at least partially, why the descendants received retribution. Saul, of course, was already dead. I think there's a lesson here. You know, when a group of people abuse somebody and they never make it right, it results in a situation where God does not bless the group until a public vindication occurs. It's worth thinking about. For further instruction, you might like to compare a couple other passages. Ezekiel 17, verses 16 to 20, you can read that. It's the judgment on an Israelite king who broke his covenant with the king of Babylon. In fact, I think maybe we'll just look at that quickly. It won't take long to read. Ezekiel 17, verse 16 to 20. As I live, says the Lord God, surely in the place where the king dwells who made him king, whose oath he despised and whose covenant he broke with him in the midst of Babylon, he shall die. Nor will Pharaoh with his mighty army and great company do anything in the war, when they heap up a siege mound and build a wall to cut off many persons, since he despised the oath by breaking the covenant, and in fact gave his hand and still did all these things, he shall not escape. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, as I live, surely my oath which he despised and my covenant which he broke, I will recompense on his own head. I will spread my net over him, and he shall be taken in my snare. I will bring him to Babylon, and try him there for the treason which he committed against me. You see what it's saying? This king, this Israelite king, made a treaty with the king of Babylon, and then he broke his treaty. And God is saying that is a very serious offense. It reminds me of Psalm 15, verses 1 and 4. God's blessing is on those who keep their promises, even if keeping those promises becomes costly to them. Who will ascend to the hill of the Lord? It's somebody who swears to his own hurt and changes not. See what the idea is there? You made some kind of agreement, and then later you find out, oops, that's going to cost me more than I thought. I think I'll change it. Oh, no. You proceed with what you've promised. The implications here is that God holds us responsible for promises we make, even if the other party was deceptive. I believe we need to let that sink down into our ears. That means you make careful investigation before you make promises. By the way, just as a little aside, that means if you're considering who to marry, you give it time. You think carefully. You pray. You give it time. You don't say, oh, this is it. I just found it. I'm sure it's it. Because when you give it time and you think carefully and you investigate details and you pray, God can show you things that might be hidden. But once you make that commitment and say, yes, I take this person as my wife or my husband, whichever the case may be, then you're committed. When we think of the story of the Gibeonites, what is the primary lesson? It seems obvious the primary lesson is we must ask counsel of God even before we make what we might think is an obvious or small decision. Many times, things that we think are small at the moment have a way of becoming very big later. It's so easy to be self-sufficient. It's so easy to be complacent. And even if we clearly recognize that the success we had in the past was from God's blessing, we can become complacent in the fact that we were just blessed by God. That song that we sing sometimes is a very useful song. It says, I need thee every hour, most gracious Lord. And then I think a second thing that we can learn from this passage is not everything is lost when we make a mistake. Joshua was not deliberately sinning. He made a mistake. The elders of Israel were not deliberately sinning. They made a mistake in the sense of thought the Gibeonites were from a far country. So they did the wrong thing, but the Gibeonites had to serve in the worship system, and that may have contributed to their subsequent faithfulness down through the centuries. There is no evidence that they ever led Israel into idolatry. In fact, it seems like that they were more faithful than some of the Israelites. What it shows is that God can bring beauty out of ashes. But remember, you never burn the house down to see what God will do with the ashes when you're done. See, that would be a belligerent stupidity. So when we consider this story, the primary thing to remember is we need to avoid self-sufficiency and complacency even when the wonderful results we have, we know they came from God. And call upon Him, ask Him for wisdom, even in things that may seem little at the time. Or things that may seem obvious at the time. See, that's what these people thought. Huh, well, yes, their bread is moldy. Their bread is dry. Their wineskins are patched. Their sandals are falling apart. Well, yes, it must have taken a long time to get here. Instead of really doing their homework. And the most important part of homework they would have done is what? To have asked at the mouth of God. For next time, study chapter 10 and 11.